Again, we're waiting for the start of a live broadcast from the 2016 Aspen Ideas Festival, GMOs, Savior Satan, or something in between. Genetically modified organism. Rarely have three words generated such passionate and polarized debate. GMO has become a cultural construct, a metaphor we use to argue about a set of ideas that don't fit neatly into any clear category. Consumer and worker health, corporate greed, biodiversity, the role of the green revolution, productive farming and the developing world, innovation versus tradition, ethics. If one thing is clear, it's that the emotional debates have overshadowed thoughtful discussion about the role of biotechnology. Can it help more than it can harm? How fast and in what direction should our agricultural innovation advance? That lecture coming up in just a moment.
Killeen Bratman with the Aspen Institute, and it is my pleasure to welcome everyone to the first full day of the festival and our very first session in our food track. We have some amazing speakers over the next 3 days that are going to be talking about a better way to feed this planet. And in typical festival fashion, we're going to start out with what I'm sure will be a very spirited discussion about GMOs. So it's my pleasure to introduce our moderator today, Helena Bottomiller-Evich, who is the senior reporter for Politico, who covers food policy and politics. So take it away, Helena.
Thank you. Thank you all for joining us this morning. I think, as you can tell from the title of this session, GMOs have been a very polarizing and emotional debate. If you didn't read the title, it is GMOs, Saviors, Satan, or Something in Between. In many ways, this title just illustrates the debate that we have had on this topic. I've actually had several people suggest to me recently I was brave for agreeing to moderate this panel. Someone yesterday told me I drew the short straw, even. But in all seriousness, I'm delighted to moderate this discussion because I think we can make it better. I think it deserves a nuanced, serious, substantive debate, a more substantive debate than we've had. And so I'm hoping that we can deliver that today. Inspire some new thinking around this, and really move the debate forward. We really have a great panel here. We have truly some of the smartest voices in this entire space. I'm going to introduce them briefly, but please read their impressive bios in the app. We don't have a ton of time here to talk about a very thorny discussion, so we're going to try to move quickly through things. Please think about questions. We're going to save ample time for questions at the end. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce the panel, and we're going to get started. So first we have Ricardo Salvador. He is the senior scientist and director of the Food and Environment Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and really a leading voice in the food movement. Before joining UCS, he was a program officer for the Food, Health, and Well-Being program with the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Prior to that, he was an associate professor of agronomy at Iowa State University, where he taught the first course in sustainable agriculture at a land-grant university. Then we have Robert Fraley, who is an executive vice president and chief technology officer at Monsanto Company. He has been with Monsanto for 30 years and oversees its global technology division, which includes plant breeding and plant biotechnology, among other things. Fraley is also really widely considered the founder of agriculture biotechnology, having produced the world's first GMO plant. He's a true pioneer in this field. He has won numerous awards, including the World Food Prize, for his work. Then we have David Festa, who's a senior vice president of ecosystems at the Environmental Defense Fund. He oversees initiatives to reverse habitat loss and working lands and do other important but maybe they sound unsexy things, like eliminating fertilizer pollution in agriculture, Something the group is actually tackling at a pretty impressive scale right now, which is something that wasn't really on my radar, so ask him about that. Previously, Festa led EDF's Oceans program, where he changed the way fisheries are managed. So before we dive in here, I thought it would be helpful to get a sense of where the room is in this debate. So we're going to do a really quick lightning round poll of the room. No judgment, just raise your hand. Okay, so raise your hand if you think GMOs have environmental benefits. Okay. Raise your hand if you think there are food safety concerns with GMOs. All right. Raise your hands if you think GMOs should be labeled. Okay. Well, I think that is an... We can read the room. Thank you.
Meeting's over.
No, meeting's not over. The meeting is not over. So to start us off here, I want to start with a very simple question. And this may seem overly simple, but it really is important, I think, to nail down what exactly we are talking about when we talk about GMOs. What is a GMO? Are we grouping all of these crops and technologies together in a way that makes sense? I mean, we have everything from a fast-growing salmon to pest-resistant corn. Have we oversimplified this issue? And I want each of you to sort of talk about how you parse this out and what you consider a GMO. So, David, I want to start with you, and then we'll kick it to the rest of the panel.
Well, the simple answer is yes, we have oversimplified it. I really think that there's three parts to this debate. The first is about the process, biotechnology, the kind of science that's used to create a product. And that's the second part of this, a product. BT corn or salmon, fast-growing salmon, that's a product. And then the third part is how the product is managed. How is it regulated? How do farmers or others use it in the field? And each of those has different issues associated with them. And I think one of the things that we see is that how the product has been managed has created some controversies and therefore undermined public trust in the tool itself, biotechnology itself. And we need to start rebuilding that trust.
So, Rob, what is a GMO? You're like the father of this technology.
Well, actually,
has it been misunderstood? And
yeah, I think we've actually overcomplicated it. You know, the way I look at it, I grew up on a small farm in Illinois. I look at all the crops we grow in this country. They've all been genetically modified. In fact, if you were on the boat that came with Columbus and you looked at what crops were in the United States back then, it would have been strawberries and sunflowers. Everything else we grow in this country, whether it's the vegetable crops and the tomatoes that came from Peru, the corn that came from Mexico, the soybeans that came from China, all were genetically modified, adapted, and grow here. And so we've been modifying our crops from the beginning of the time using breeding, using selection, using mutagenesis, all kinds of techniques basically to change the genetic structure and select for better and better seeds. And with the biotechnology methods that were developed, we're able to do that even faster and do it even more precisely. And I think it's really part of a continuum. And as we look in the future with new techniques like gene editing and other opportunities, we're going to be able to continue to improve crops, to reduce waste, and to bring benefits to farmers all around the world. So I think it's an important technology. It's not a silver bullet, but it's a tool that's been really helpful for farmers around the world to improve their productivity and reduce food waste and crop loss.
So Ricardo, what do you think about this? Do you think most people, A, understand what a GMO is, and how is this fit into the broader conversation we've been having? I mean, you see this upsurge of consumer interest. Where does that fit into this whole agriculture conversation? I mean, what do people know what a GMO even is?
Yeah, it is a difficult concept to understand. Ultimately, what we're talking about is the way that we do the modification that Rob just described, and I'd like to agree, first of all, with David's characterization that we need to distinguish the underlying molecular biology, the science of this, from the products that we generate, which is the technology that turns knowledge into useful information. And then that needs to be distinguished from the way that it's deployed, which means to what end and who benefits. And often, because it is the private sector that's in charge of that part, we're talking about the business model. And so it's important to distinguish when examining and critiquing the issue which one of those three areas we're talking about, or more than one. And that's one of the reasons why this is complicated. Now, last night we spoke, I don't know if I'm going to get ahead of you here, but we spoke to prepare, and I thought that one very useful thing to do, because this is a tired debate, I particularly feel strongly about that. The important thing is to figure out where we have areas of agreement and then talk about what the future of both of these different areas are, the science, the technology, the business models with which the technology is deployed. So one place where I think we have unanimous agreement is that it serves no purpose to act as if we didn't understand the way that the genome works. We've learned a great deal about the underlying science. That's the science of molecular biology. And plant breeding as a whole would be impossible today without the way in which that science has actually been applied. So any breeding program that is making any progress around the planet is actually employing the techniques that came out of understanding the way that the genome works. So this is a really important thing. Plant breeding has become much more effective and stands to become still much more effective in terms of rate of progress and singling out the specific traits that we wish to improve and introduce as a result of the science, the molecular biology. So that's an area of agreement. The food safety thing, I see already that I'm going to be in the minority in this group here. There really is no evidence that the way that the technology has been deployed to date, there's any reason why any of us need to be concerned around the food safety, although I'll introduce one caveat here. That is because the majority of the crops in which this technology has actually been deployed are very large industrial crops, commodity crops. They support the processed food industry. By the time that you actually ingest something that comes from, quote, a GMO food, you're actually eating something that's highly processed an ingredient. You're going to be eating either the sugar, you know, some vitamin, some highly reduced, highly processed item
or
that
bacon.
Is coming from it.
Or bacon.
In the case of meat, there you've gone two generations at least from the actual crop itself. And so by the time that you're eating the tissue of the pork, which has been fed on the biotech crops. But the point that I wanted to make about this is that if you get into trouble with food safety as a result of eating ingredients that come from processing biotech crops, it's because you're eating too much sugar rather than the way that that was originated. So there are some areas of agreement that I think that we have. Now, we discovered last night we have areas of disagreement that we'll proceed to discuss with Helena's tutelage here.
I was hoping we were going to agree on everything. You know, one of the things we talked about last night that I think just as a, you know, as we were doing the warm-up for the audience here, does anybody have any idea what the first GMO product was and when it was introduced? Corn? No, the very first product was introduced in 1982. It was human insulin. So the before you had the GMO technology, the way you if you were a diabetic, they would extract the insulin directly from animals, and that's where you would get your injections. And way back in the late 70s, scientists cloned the human insulin gene, expressed it in a bacteria. That's the whole thing of a GMO, is moving a gene from one species to another. And now they could produce the insulin, genuine human insulin, in, you know, laboratory conditions that were sterile. They didn't have to worry about, you know, contamination with viruses. So that was the first GMO product ever developed. And today, about half of the world's drugs are based on GMO technology. All the new, when you see that TV commercial about a biological, that is a GMO product. And actually, the first GMO product for food, you know what that one was? Yeast. Production of chymosin to make cheese. So again, you know, and that was introduced in 1990. And the point is to turn milk into cheese, you have to have an enzyme to cleave the casein protein. It used to be you would extract that enzyme from the stomachs of animals. Again, the world's appetite for cheese is so great that the way we do it today is we manufacture that enzyme. It's a GMO product, and almost 90% of the cheeses that we eat in the U.S. are GMOs. And the whole point of going into this is we're going to focus, you know, the rest of the time on GMOs and food and crops, but one of the things that's really important for the group to appreciate is GMOs comprise a big part of our healthcare, a big part of our food system, And a couple of my favorite examples are the fact that all of the detergents that we use, and the reason you can wash your laundry in cold water is because they have enzymes that are GMO products that take away the disease. But my my favorite one is the pet fish that glow in the dark. And those are fish that actually contain genes from algae and coral so that they glow in the dark. So we even have GMO pets.
So it sounds like you all agree that the science, just genetic modification at its core, has probably been over-vilified, misunderstood. It's not that part of it. It's other parts of it that have to be sort of examined separately and with nuance and with each crop or product you're looking at. And I want to move forward on where we agree and where this technology should go. But first, I do think it's important to hear a little bit from you about why you think we are where we are in this debate. This room of highly educated, very informed people have very different, even polarizing views in this room. How did we get to this place where it's an emotional debate, it's polarized? I mean, if you look on Twitter, which I actually track this a lot because of the Senate bill, which we'll hopefully get to, if you just type GMO into Twitter, you are either, almost without exception, going to get champions of biotech that are just slamming people who don't understand it as just Luddites and, you know, anti-science. And then you have critics who think it, I mean, truly, it is one or the other, critics who just think it's evil. And there's very little middle ground. How did we get to this place if you know, you all have very different backgrounds, come at this from different places, that you don't necessarily see that the science underpinning this is scary or causes food safety problems. How did we get here? Why are we in a place where more than half the country thinks there are food safety concerns?
I think there's sort of three components to it. One is that as a general public, I mean, we have actually had experiences where things have gone wrong. I grew up in the South, and in the 30s or so, there was a concern about erosion. And USDA and others had this great idea of introducing this plant that would stabilize the hillsides. Well, that's kudzu. So that's caused lots and lots of problems. And we know we have invasive species issues. So as a public, we're aware that things can go really wrong when you introduce a new novel organism, life form, into a place where it hasn't been before. So we actually have some reason to think about this, some actual experience. The second thing is that the regulatory approaches that we have to managing this really haven't caught up with the science. So we have two agencies that are involved in GMOs. One is the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA. The other is the Food and Drug Administration. And imagine the confusion or the challenge in the Food and Drug Administration when they're approving all kinds of drugs that come from GMOs, and then they're presented with something like genetically modified salmon. Well, what do they call the gene that they're inserting into the salmon? It's classified by FDA as a veterinary drug. Well, that probably is a little outdated way of looking at it. So I think there's...
It took 20 years.
it took
20 years to move through that.
Yeah. And then the third is there's a great article I can recommend to you guys. It was in Fortune magazine about 2 weeks ago on Monsanto. And I think it's, you know, there is a... One of the things that the article points out is confidence in the technology blinded folks and folks at Monsanto, too, to the need to really be very transparent and publicly defend and talk about this technology. And I think sort of a overconfidence in the science is another reason why we kind of let this issue get out of control.
Yeah, Rob, I'm curious how you...
Yeah, and there's some of those comments I think are absolutely on track. So, you know, just kind of go back. The first, we're celebrating now the 20th anniversary of the first GMO crops that were introduced in 96. So, you know, we discovered the technology to be able to do this in 1982. It took us about 15 years to really refine the technology, do the regulatory studies. I actually think our regulatory system, which involves both the EPA, USDA, and FDA, is really the gold standard. But
One of the things that, in addition, you know, if we're growing corn or soybean in the U.S., they get shipped around the world. We receive regulatory approval from 30 or 40 other countries who've also reviewed the science in detail. There's no doubt these are the most thoroughly studied food products in the food system. But I think going back to the point that you're getting to, you know, back in 96, like most companies, we got our regulatory approvals. We worked to bring these products into the marketplace for farmers around the world. I think one of the points we ought to just, you know, acknowledge, and I'll be happy to share with you, I think, all the things that we did wrong and all of the mistakes we made, because those are important to talk about. But 20 years later, the GMO technology is being used by farmers in over 30 countries. It's being used on hundreds of millions of acres, and it's helping farmers reduce their cost and control their bugs and weeds, which are really an important cause of crop loss and food waste. So, you know, we put our effort into talking to farmers. I absolutely agree with David. Back then, we did not see the opportunity and the need for the direct to public communication to really, because you just, you know, if you got a regulatory approval, you sold your product. And we did a poor job of that. In the meantime, a lot of the critics of the technology who were much more effective at using social media were able to fearmonger and demonize the technology. About 3 or 4 years ago, we woke up. We realized we made a mistake. We've changed a lot of our approaches on transparency, on communication, and we know we've got a lot of work to do to communicate. You know, for me, it's a real interesting parallel to what happened, again, in the pharmaceutical world. You know, right back at about that same time in 97, there was a scientific paper published by Andy Wakefield in The Lancet that claimed that there was a correlation between the MMR vaccine and the problems that could be created with autism. The data was faked. The medical community didn't respond quickly and effectively. It became a rumor on social media, and still today we have communities that are and people that are making the wrong decisions for the wrong reasons. And I see that parallel because it really points out how important, and I always talk about this, that, you know, the science is critical. You have to have great science to have great products, but the science itself is insufficient. And you have to be able to win the public trust, the public understanding, and that's going to be key, I think, to all these new technologies for the future, whether it's GMOs, whether it's, you know, microbials, whether it's gene editing. It's a new standard, and that's the standard we have to reach to.
Why do you think, though, that consumers have had so much more skepticism about this technology versus, you know, iPhones or even the excitement around self-driving cars or other, or even biotech and healthcare has not gotten the same? I mean, is there something kind of visceral that you think consumers?
Yeah, I mean, and we talked about it last night, and I agreed with Ricardo's comments. I mean, food is a much more personal and emotional topic. I mean, I can remember when we first launched the technologies, and you know, the GMO soybeans were being shipped to Europe. I mean, there was strong European reaction. That really taught me that, you know, different people have different relationships with food. But I think one of the goals and the common ground that this panel, you know, I think in the end acknowledges is we know there will be more people. We know there will be more challenges growing crops with less water, that we'll have to grow crops effectively with climate change. And it's going to take new technologies. It's going to take advances in biology, data science, precision agriculture. So I think one of our challenges as we demonize one aspect of one technology is to make sure that in the end, society makes the right decision to move forward with innovation in farming and food production so that that next generation can enjoy a better food supply and an improved environment.
Do you think the resistance to mandatory labeling has bred any of the skepticism or fed any of the skepticism? I mean, it's kind of interesting that we're in this moment where GMO labeling is being debated in Congress, but it's 20 years later. It's come, you know, it's a belated sort of climax of that debate, and the Senate now has a bipartisan compromise to create a national solution. It's not mandatory on pack, it's mandatory disclosure, which, can include a QR code or some sort of symbol or unpack.
A symbol or words.
Yeah.
I think.
So there's flexibility there. But do you think that, I mean, people who don't understand this at all, don't understand the science, they hear, you know, oh, it's they don't want to tell us. Do you think that that message has hurt the technology?
I do, and I don't think it's been handled really well. And labeling is a complicated conversation with all different viewpoints. Just tell you where our company stands is we have always been supportive of the voluntary labeling systems. I personally think that's the best approach. So if you've got a USDA organic stamp, by definition, that's non-GMO. And then there's, you know, a variety of services that you know, support the non-GMO project. That's the way the system should work, because if the food company is going to benefit from selling a differentiated product, and they're gaining the profit or the marketing advantage of doing that, then they should absorb the costs for that system. And that's would be a very rational approach. What we have opposed is the mandatory labeling at a state-by-state level, because it, you know, to have farmers who have farms in one state and another state have to have different segregation systems for their crops to comply with different laws, and I think it would hurt farmers, it would hurt the food companies. The solution is mandatory labeling at the federal level. That's effectively what we have with the organic standard. The organic standard, modulated by the and put in place and maintained by the USDA, is a national federal standard.
A non-GMO
For non-GMO.
Yeah.
So the way to do a mandatory label for GMOs is to do it at the federal level, so that all consumers have access to the same information, and it's not done, you know, in a haphazard state by state fashion. So I think the compromise that's on the table today makes a lot of sense, and we would fully support it.
But the industry
opposed. A second to your question of why it's more volatile in food, and I think part of it is also that the thing about science and biotech is that it accelerates our ability to do things. So we can make bigger jumps in technology. We can make them faster. And historically, we've made those jumps slowly and over time, and we've had a chance to adjust and kind of see and get used to it. We're moving really fast now. And that then begins to, and you put it into food, where so much of food, it's also a debate about the food system. And so if you are opposed to the monoculture in farming, then the advent of GMO crops that actually help that, you really get into a debate about some of the underlying values that we have in our food system. And I think that also makes it really complicated, and also very important then to parse out what we're arguing about.
Mm-hmm. But is it possible, just to go back to the labeling issue, and I want to move forward after that, but is it possible that if you, because the industry has been agreed now to do mandatory disclosure, which would include a QR code, which means you could scan it on your phone, but it wouldn't say, the text would not say contains genetically engineered ingredients, which is what Vermont wants everyone to do.
Or a logo or words.
I
mean, I think
there's flexibility, but it's not mandatory on-pack, which is what the labeling advocates wanted. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that mandatory on-pack would end up just not being a big deal? People would see it, accept it, keep making the same choices, move on, and this has been a huge fight about very little. I mean, is it possible that, like, let's say the Congress doesn't get this done. You know, they're not the most effective these days, so I'm not totally counting on them to get the bill done, even though it's bipartisan, has industry support. I still don't know. Maybe it will happen. But if Vermont becomes the national standard, that which does require words on the package, on the back, underneath the nutrition facts, if that does go through and everyone has to label, a lot of companies are already labeling. What if it turns out it just doesn't matter and people accept it and say, oh, that's nice, they're disclosing it, and move on? Is that possible that's the outcome?
If that's the outcome and public trust level rises in the tool, I think that's, I'm going to call it a win.
Yeah, I would too. I think
a national labeling
approach is the right way to go. The challenge is just don't do it city by city and state by state. Mm-hmm. That would be
patchwork. And I think everyone agrees that the patchwork is a bad idea.
But that's where we were starting with California, Colorado, mm-hmm. everybody setting up a different system with different exceptions. It was so confusing that no one could understand the system. Having it done at a federal level, just like we have the organic standard, just makes all kinds of sense.
Do you think that Congress will get this done?
I hope so. I hope so. I mean, I think it's, you know, it is very logical. It's an outcome that I think serves both the consumers and agriculture and farmers and everybody involved to have a system that's transparent and functioning.
So looking forward to where this technology could go, I'm curious to hear from each of you, what applications do you think will be the most important to both move forward not only food security, not only climate adaptation, but also trust in this technology, whether it's applied by, you know, a public university coming up with some innovation or whether it's a corporation? What are the types of uses, applications, where does this need to go so that we're getting the most kind of bang for the buck going forward? What do you see on the horizon? I don't know if, Rob, you want to start because you're just in the middle of all this.
Well, you know, it's what's exciting.
You should see the horizon.
There are so many, you know, so many innovations coming in agriculture. It's a wonderful time. I was just out in San Francisco 2 days ago meeting with 400 entrepreneurial investors who were looking at data science tools, satellite images, sensors, new food methods and new crop production methods. I mean, the whole ability to farm more exactly, more precisely, to understand the exact genetics in that seed that will produce the best taste, flavor, and outcome, to be able to plant that seed, vary it across that field to make it more applicable is going to be wonderful. And the beauty of those tools are that, you know, they benefit farmers all around the world. You know, one of the things I'm most proud of with the progress with GMOs is there are farmers in 30 countries using this technology, from large farmers in, you know, the United States and Brazil and Argentina to smallholders in across Africa India. Because if you think about it, great, wonderful technology in breeding and biotechnology, but the end product is a better seed, and every farmer knows what to do with the seed. So the barriers to adoption are very low. The barriers to adoption for the data science tools are remarkably low. We don't think about it, but 7 out of every 10 farmers in Africa has a cell phone. And that cell phone becomes the conduit to get weather information, to get agronomic advice, to get understanding of the market, and really importantly, to get microcredit so that they can cut out the loan shark in the village. These two tools, I think the advances in biology, the advances in data science, transform farming around the world and make it better and more precise. And, you know, it's just kind of like the same trend going on in human healthcare. Human healthcare is taking us to individualized medicine so that you know exactly the right treatment for your body based on your genetics, your DNA, your genes, and a deep understanding of the problem that you have. Same thing is going on with farmers. Farmers today know the composition of the genetics of their seeds. They've mapped each one of their fields. There's now imagery that lets them look at that crop around the world grow. We're going to be able to farm so much more smarter, and that's going to be key, because I think in the future, you know, we can improve productivity. We can probably shrink the amount of land that's needed to produce our food supply, and I think that's a win from both a food security and from an environment perspective.
Ricardo, do you think that where we're focusing, are we focusing on the right places, like helping farmers, say, adapt to the changing climate or have more resilient systems, more, you know, disease resistance? Do you think that the direction the technology is going is where we should be going?
As I said earlier, I think the research, the basic science in this ought to be done. Some of the technologies are promising. So far, I find none of the business models actually serving the ends that you just described. But
Do you think there needs to be more public research?
Yes,
into the,
absolutely.
Is that part of the problem?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
More money, of course. Congress is really eager to give more money.
Agriculture is way underfunded relative to healthcare and other industries. And
so here's a place where finally we can get some excitement into the conversation. So while I agree with the panorama that you've just described, Rob, it is a very rosy view of the world. And it is also based very much on forgive me, but a Tony position in the structure of agriculture in the world. There was very recently a report issued by the National Academy of Sciences, which I found to be a very well done, methodical, very balanced report. And one of the things that they mentioned about this very point, after having covered thousands of scientific articles that examined questions such as these, was that the benefit of the technology, the biotech, actually disproportionately benefits a particular scale of farmer. And this shouldn't surprise any of us, but here they documented this. And they say, if we wish for the types of smaller scale farmers, who, by the way, do represent the hungry and the poor of the planet and practice self-provisioning agriculture, then there are a whole set of support mechanisms that we assume from our perch in the first world that they will have and that they don't have, and that are major barriers to their access to this technology. So very basic things, access to credit, for instance. These seeds are not being dispensed by philanthropy. It costs a tremendous amount of money to generate them, so business needs to recoup its investment. So they're expensive seeds. And so farmers need access to credit. They need access to a number of different technologies that actually would pay them back the investment that they would make in just the seed, because just the seed on their own are not going to make the additional production. They need access to markets and so on. So immediately this turns into a question where, as I've said before, the technology is an important component, but as David has said, the question is really about the system of agriculture that we want to create. So then I come back to your question. There are ways in which we can deal with the big climate change challenges that farmers of all scales all over the planet will need to confront. There are ways that we can deal with drought. There are ways that we can deal with pests and all of the pressures that farmers need to deal with. Biotech is one of the ways in which we may do this, subject to the constraints that we've just discussed here. And here's the clincher. Here's the place for some heat. I don't think they're particularly necessary. There are alternatives, very viable alternatives that can be applied either independently or in conjunction with biotech methods. So to frame the whole discussion as if, you know, biotech or we perish, it's a little bit of an exaggeration. And the inverse of that, you know, biotech and then everything will be fine. So unfortunately, you know, we have 35 minutes to try to tease that stuff out of there. But here's a place where we have a significantly different worldview about the place of that technology. I should say also, to be fair, you would predict just as much. You know, there's billions of dollars at stake in profit and the survival of a company. That doesn't single out Monsanto. Every company has that challenge. And obviously, there's an economic interest. That's what drives the advocacy for that particular decades-long investment in that technology and the products that come of it. So some of us are able to analyze and speak without the constraint that we've invested in that particular technology.
I'm not sure there's really that much disagreement. I think one of the myths out there that exists is that this is all about GMOs. You know, so I am the guy, along with a great team of colleagues, who put the first gene in a petunia plant. You can imagine what that was like when you're working in a big company, that the first crop you produce is a petunia plant. But that was the demonstration that we could actually do that with a gene. And as I said, we took another 15 years to figure out how to make the technology work with crops that mattered to farmers around the world. But when I look back at the impact that we've had, by far the biggest impact that the biotechnology tools have had has been how they've enhanced breeding around the world, which is the point you made. In fact, a lot of people don't appreciate this, but of our research budget, our R&D budget, about 60% of it is plant breeding, and about a quarter of it is biotechnology and GMOs. And the whole point is that the way we breed crops today, we literally know the sequence of every single gene in a crop. So if it's a tomato plant, it has about 25,000 genes. If it's a corn plant, it has 45,000 genes. They're mapped, they're sequenced, so when the breeders are making those crosses, they can pick out the combinations that will create that next best new seed for the world. And what's important, and I guess you know, there's certainly a for-profit focus on this. We provide better seeds that give farmers better yields and better performance. And frankly, 18 million farmers around the world purchase these seeds every day because they improve their operations. But the other side of it is really cool. We've had a 7-year history with the Gates Foundation where our entities have committed resources and support to donate this technology for the poorest of the poor, the smallholder farmers, and we're expanding that relationships to other crops. What I see is that the cost curve to sequence a genome or to map a genome has gotten to the point where I think almost every, you know, minor crop in the world is going to see the use of these tools, and I think it's going to be transformational to relieve farmers from the burden of using, you know, old seeds that don't have the productivity, that don't have the drought tolerance, that don't have the resilience to disease and pests, and they don't have to use GMOs. The breeding techniques are so important that it's key that we get them in the hands of smallholders around the world, and there's many vehicles to do that.
So do you think if you applied these maybe even GMOs, if you were to look and say, let's do more genetic modification for consumer-facing products. Like now we have the non-browning apple. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's very widely adopted yet. But do you think that there's a chance that consumers might go, oh, there's a benefit to me? Like my colleague Jenny Hopkinson, I think she's already asked you this. She always says the way you get millennials on board with GMOs is to make a GMO avocado that doesn't brown. So is that coming? That might be the key to people going, oh, no, I'm cool with this. But I don't know. Well, I mean, is that part of it that in the future maybe we'll see, or maybe they won't be GMOs because the breeding science is becoming so precise that you don't need...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a possibility. I mean, you know, I've got my pet glowfish in the office. And you can buy, you know, pet glowfish.
What about the avocado, Rob? I mean,
we've already got the papaya. One of the first GMO products was the virus-resistant papaya that basically saved the papaya industry. So there's been consumer products. I mean, probably the product that we're most excited about that has direct consumer benefit are the production of soybeans with reduced fatty acid content that's more cardiovascular friendly, higher enrichment in omega-3s. Since, you know, about 60% of the U.S. Consumption of fats and oils comes from soya, either directly through soya products or through animals fed soya. So improving the health profile of these basic foods, I think, has an enormous consumer benefit.
You're going to also have to explain that to consumers, though, because they won't understand that it came from
that. Well, that's what
that.
We have you for. Well, you know, I mean, that, we don't want to take away your job, right? I mean...
yes, there's so that, many
like,
food policy
I will fully admit that this is a tough challenge on communication, but let's step back for a second. You know, I love the National Geographic article of a few months ago that came out that said, you know, about half of the people in this country don't believe that man landed on the moon, that don't believe that believe that vaccines, you know, cause autism. You know, 49% of the people don't believe in evolution. So the idea of explaining what plant breeding and GMOs are is a big challenge. But you know, you got to give. But we're seeing it. I mean, you know, we've seen the benefits in healthcare. We've seen the benefits in so many other aspects. We need to work as a society to close that gap because, you know, to have someone make the wrong personal decisions, the wrong regulatory decisions, the wrong policy decisions because they really didn't understand the consequences. You know, I think we're seeing a little bit of remorse in Britain today for, you know, making the wrong decision for the wrong reason. And that's what we want to avoid as a society.
Do you want to add final thoughts, David, before we kick it to the audience?
I just think you asked sort of what's the future. And I think one of the really important things in the future is to spend more time really thinking carefully through the risks associated with the products. So, for example, Roundup has had a lot of benefits for agriculture, but generally speaking...
Explain what Roundup is.
Roundup is a herbicide, very effective herbicide. So it kills weeds, and that has led to the ability of farmers to have virtually weed-free farming. And that has benefits in terms of yield. It also has benefits in terms of helping them uptake things that, as a conservationist, I care about, like low-till agriculture, low-till farming practices. But it turns out that if you have no weeds in your field, there's nothing for other things like the monarch butterfly to eat. So we've created another problem. That's a risk that was actually foreseeable. And now, in my lifetime, we've seen the populations of monarch butterflies crash 90%. It's like, why? Oh, well, lots of reasons, but this is certainly one of them. I think we need to do a better job of anticipating those risks. And I'm definitely not saying, if there's a risk, let's not do anything. But let's do a better job of anticipating what those risks are. And then instead of playing catch-up, which we are doing now, and I actually have a lot of optimism on things like pollinators, that butterflies, that we actually will be able to address this problem. But we're playing catch-up. And we don't. And I think rebuilding the public trust, in addition to having non-browning avocados, if we also have trust that we are, in a clear-eyed, transparent way, identifying what the risks are and figuring out how to take steps to minimize those risks so we can enjoy the benefits, that's going to go a long way to rebuilding that trust.
Yeah, that's a great point. I want to kick it to the audience because I'm sure that you have questions. We're going to go right here in the blue and then red shirt right there. Please state your name.
Hi, my name is Bill Resnick. So I came today because I'm confused. I've heard both sides, and although the anti-GMO side has not been very clear, and I'd say the one thing that I've heard that I'd like some clarity on is one of the risks is kind of it creates or encourages more monoculture, and you touched on it briefly, but I'd like to understand what are the risks of that. My very vague understanding is that it's good for the soil or good for the sort of the land if there are many crops being grown together, and that with GMOs you tend to grow one crop. So maybe I could hear a little bit more about that and how big a risk that is and what's really known.
That's a great question. Do GMOs matter in monoculture? Would we have monoculture?
We're going to have a lot of questions. And I did pass out my business card on the packet here, but also on the website, I've written a couple of articles about monoculture and other things that, in case we don't get a chance to get into a depth answer. I would say that the monoculture is really one of those myths that we need to spend a little bit of time debunking. You know, I told you I was out in San Francisco crossing Central Valley a couple days ago. All of the Central Valley is a monoculture of lettuce, of broccoli, and it doesn't matter whether it's conventional agriculture or organic. Crops are grown by themselves in a single species. When you guys plant your gardens, I mean, how many of you are gardeners? How many of you actually, in the same row, put a strawberry next to an onion plant next to a tomato? Nobody does that because you're trying to weed. Well, a couple of you, all right. I grant you, you're going to need to help us in the Central Valley. But all crops are grown in monocultures, whether they're organic, whether they're conventional, whether they're GMOs. The beauty of the system in the Central Midwest is that farmers are making the decision each year whether to plant soybeans or corn. If they're farther north, they'll plant wheat or canola. If they're farther south, they'll plant peanuts or cotton, depending on the market conditions. So they're making a decision each year in response to market pressure, demand, consumer interest to plant those crops. And I think it's a huge benefit to have that kind of flexibility. When I'm out in California, I always make the point, if you want to talk about real monocultures, talk about the million acres of almond trees that are going to be there for 25 years, or the grapes that don't even yield until they're 20 years old. Those are monocultures with big commitments. I like the fact that, you know, we have an extremely flexible system that's efficient. But the myth is that you grow organic crops in long rows of broccoli and you grow corn the same way. And it's really not related to the technology at all.
So can I add to this just a little bit? So, Mr. Resnick, I'm not sure that I'm going to help with the confusion, but I do have a different perspective than what we've just heard. So, Rob, as I understand what you just said, is it isn't just the corn-soy monoculture. There's lots of monocultures, mm-hmm. but that doesn't address the issue of monoculture mm-hmm. itself. So, you know, this will be a little bit of competing websites, but because the topic is complicated, if you want to hear a little bit more about what I'll just tease you with right now, at the Union of Concerned Scientists, we have information on a way of farming that is based on a whole body of science that is known as agroecology, which is predicated on farming in a way that actually works with natural dynamics primarily diversity, which is what you would find in naturally in ecosystems. You find a great deal of diversity. It provides balance. Farming systems based on that principle don't create a lot of the problems at large scale that then we find a need to try to solve with some of the technologies that we're discussing here. You prevent them to begin with. That type of system, so I'm an agronomist, Rob is a molecular biologist, so from the standpoint of an agronomist, that type of system makes far more ecological sense and can be more efficient in terms of utilizing the primary driving resource in agriculture, which is sunlight. So that monoculture system that we're describing was not put in place by GMOs. It vastly preceded it. It actually does help to reinforce. So one thing to mention, particularly around the technology that David described, the use case for utilizing that particular system of Roundup-ready crops, it's not just the herbicide, but it's a system. The use case is you have thousands of acres to manage. You want to get into the field and cover as many acres as possible, as quickly as possible, with a reasonable certainty that you will effectively control the weed. The solution is to come up with an herbicide that will kill everything but the crop that you're spraying. And it leads to consequent problems in terms of accelerating the resistance of certain weeds that have the gene potential to resist that particular herbicide. Something that was foreseen, Rob foresaw. He talked to Fortune magazine about that possibility. And we're now dealing with it. And the way that you deal with it, actually, the seed companies themselves, agronomists, biotech companies, are begging farmers to introduce diversity into their system through rotations, through refuges, and so on. So as I mentioned, there's much more to say about this. I'll sort of just, you know, tease you a little bit to go to that website in the sense that this system has a lot of weaknesses, whereas here we haven't really talked about those. But go check that website and you'll find more information.
Okay. One of the real cool things is there's a lot that we can learn from agroecology farming practices, and probably one of the best tools that's been adopted now into the conventional farming system has been the use of cover crops and some of the irrigation practices. So I think when you really get into it, you know, there's a real common ground where these practices can be shared and provide for benefit.
Cover crops are another great one. They're not sexy, but very important. Okay. Right here. And we're going to try to go quick.
My name is Benton Kasman, and I grew up in West Texas where there's nothing but cotton being raised. And we're at a point where the Roundup Ready cotton has been getting used for several years, you know, which makes, you know, it's genetic way, it's resistant to the Roundup, but keep growing. But we do have several weeds that are becoming resistant to it. And part of the, you know, problem is the economic value of the crop, because cotton has to be planted first, because it's the one, you know, farmers are on a razor thin profit margin, and if they can't get the cotton to grow, there's very little for us to raise, you know, because I mean we can go to grains and some other things, and you know now we're, you know, kind of getting lost on the economic sides, you know, so I just, you know if there's other options out there, you know, for crops that can make money for the farmers. You know, that's the other side of the issue. You know, we got, you know, it's really great for the genetics, but the profitability of these other crops and rotation is very minimum. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, that's the other side of the problem.
I don't know if you want to respond to that or we'll keep going.
Yeah, it's well stated.
White shirt right here. Very enthusiastic.
Okay. You talked about a lot of stuff. The one thing you didn't hit on was what are the health concerns of the anti-GMO camp? I mean, am I going to go blind, get cancer, grow a third arm? What are you didn't touch on that.
Yeah. And, what do they argue are the concerns?
What's that?
You mean what does that side argue?
What does the anti-GMO camp, or is there any health concerns that they bring up?
Right. So just very quickly, the original legitimate question was you were going to be introducing genes that would then generate proteins, would then generate molecules that would be foreign to the original genome. That was the original concern. And when stated that way, it sounds very, very scary. Now, I'll just say to all of you, there's nothing to be scared of in terms of the concept of genes from another organism being introduced to a second organism. We wouldn't be sitting here if that process hadn't occurred. You have in every cell of your body foreign genes, you have an organelle called a mitochondrion, which is actually an ancient bacterium, which the precursors of eukaryotes, the kinds of beings that we are, actually absorb. So we have two sets of genomes that make us possible. Plants have a third set of genomes in the key organelle that they have, which is the chloroplast, another bacterium that they absorb. So it isn't that. And to this day, the concept that scientists refer to as horizontal or lateral gene flow is prevalent. It turns out it's actually a natural way in which we exchange genetic diversity. So that in itself is not scary. Genomes also tend to be very stable. It takes a lot to introduce a new trait and for it to be expressed. Rob can tell you that. And so they actually have mechanisms that suppress the introduction of new genes. So the process of evolution works through the scheme that I just described. So the original fear was legitimate. Now we were overriding that, which took place over millions of years, introducing a particular new gene that generated a new protein, new molecule. That protein could be an allergen, for instance. That protein could cause, it could be a toxin. And so what, there was an agreement among the scientists that actually developed this technology that acknowledged that that was a possibility. And that therefore, progress in developing products needed to be slowed down and that there needed to be a mechanism whereby you examined whether the new proteins were in fact allergens, because you could test for this. It wasn't like you were introducing something completely unknown. You knew what you were introducing and what it would generate. So you could test the protein product for allergenicity. There are a couple of places that actually show that that particular system worked. So I won't elaborate on this other than to say there are many reasons for all of us to be concerned about the deployment of this technology. Food safety to date is the least defensible one from the scientific standpoint.
And I don't know that we explicitly state it, but every major scientific body that has examined this question has come to the conclusion there's no evidence of human health concerns. I mean, the National Academies of Science report that just came out in May, it's 420 pages of bedtime reading, beach reading, if anyone needs it this summer, came to the same conclusion that there's no evidence, there's no evidence that shows us there should be a reason.
Let me add just one thing. We spoke about the very reductionist aspect of this. There also is the epidemiological approach. Now, we're dousing the countryside with herbicides that are part of a package that work with biotechnology crops. So this means that the environmental load of these chemicals is now far greater than it had been previously. And so that they show up all over the place. You know, not just the biotech herbicides, all herbicides show up all over the place, in rainwater, you know, in your toilet, and so on. So there is a legitimate question about what the epidemiological effect is. And so there's a lot of research done on that. None of it has been conclusive to date, and so there's attention paid to this. The nature of this research is that we're running the experiment on all of us right now. And so over a period of time, the outcomes will be evident at the epidemiological level.
Okay, I would say one of the things I'm proudest of in the 30 years that the GMO products have been in the market, and they've been grown in 30 countries around the world.
Oh, it's like 12% of, isn't it?
It's about a quarter of the world's farmland is now using the technology. And, they've had an enormous benefit of reducing pesticide use, particularly insecticides. They've helped farmers' profitability. But what I'm proudest of, in those 30 years, there's not been a single food or feed safety issue ever associated with the technology. It's an incredible record, and it's basically based on the fact that we are doing what nature has always done, inherently move and test and improve genes, but also it's a testament to the fact that there has been strong, regulatory oversight. I feel like I've just got to say one thing about, herbicide-tolerant crops are probably the most misunderstood. There's probably been more fear-mongering and commentary on herbicide-tolerant crops, and it's just worth a second to talk about why they make sense and why they've been so important for society. And I might even get David here to agree with me on parts of this. But prior to using herbicides, what we did, in fact, I was a farm boy. I would come home from school, and we would plow the fields. And we would have these beautiful black fields, and we turned the dirt over in order to control the weeds. That's how you used to control weeds. The problem was when the wind blew, the soil eroded. When it rained, the soil went down in the ditch. And so the tillage practice was causing lots of erosion. It was causing fertilizers to go into water streams. Today, farmers spray, they don't douse their fields with fertilizers. They spray about 12 ounces of or less of a, you know, a Coke-sized can on a football field. They do it very precisely with spray equipment. They avoid the tillage, which has had a remarkable effect on improving soil health and also reducing erosion. And that's a practice that I think has been hugely beneficial to the environment. And you just have to step back and do the logic. Why did companies like ourselves focus on technology to help farmers protect their crops against weeds and bugs? Well, any of you who are home gardeners know you got three challenges: weeds that compete with the crop, bugs that eat the crop, and the weather. And bugs and weeds are the major loss causes of field loss, of crop loss, and so those are the challenges that farmers around the world need to be addressed, and that's why so much of the technology is focused on these tools.
So that,
David, I'll give you
one response, and then actually we are about out of time, so I'm going to have to make this the final word.
You said douse with fertilizers. You meant douse with herbicides.
That's what you said, yeah.
I said fertilizers? Okay.
No, I think you said douse with herbicides.
Yeah, then that's what I meant. But in your response right now, you said response with douse with fertilizers.
But
here's the thing, and actually they douse with both. So, but let me now explain what this is about. In that same National Academy of Sciences study that I just referred you to, the scientists agreed on one recommendation in terms of talking about the volume of herbicides that are applied. I don't know if any of you are toxicologists in the room. The dose makes the poison, basically. So what this means is that they said that in their review of thousands of pieces of literature, they didn't find that it was helpful to talk about the amount of herbicides that are being applied, because one of the questions that we all have and that they were trying to pursue was, did the adoption of biotech crops lead to reduced use of herbicides and insecticides? Unequivocally, it led to reduced use of insecticides. Now, what they said, though, was that the toxicity of the compounds differs. True. Therefore, knowing how much is applied is not the relevant question. How much is applied times the toxicity is the relevant question. And they actually encourage scientists to stop reporting and talking about the amount that you apply, because that's not the relevant factor. So that's an important thing to mention. Now, the other thing that I'll mention, just very quickly. So I do not doubt, Rob, the precision that you just appealed to in terms of the herbicide application. Now, as Helena mentioned in her introduction, I spent 30 years in the Midwest working with farmers. And here's what I can tell you. Those particularly that manage thousands of acres cannot run the operations themselves. They contract to farm service, you know, the local co-op. These folks, these businesses, have thousands of acres that they need to manage. I can tell you that myth of precision is exactly that. They will run as quickly as they can through the field, and when they err, they want to err on the side of applying more, not less, so that the effect that they're selling you is something that you see as a farmer. So I'm not exaggerating that point. That is the fact of the way that farms are actually run.
We have to wrap up, and I'm sorry to end on such a weedy note. I hope you all learned a lot. It is hard to cover this issue in an hour, and I wish we could have taken more questions, but thank you so much for joining us. The panelists will be here to answer more questions. Thank you.
This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale. Your news, your music, your station. You've been listening to the live broadcast of GMOs, Savior, Satan, or Something in Between, from the Aspen Ideas Festival at the Aspen Institute. You can find this discussion later today on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Corporate support for the Ideas Festival broadcast on Aspen Public Radio is provided by Obermeyer Wood Investment Council, an independent investment advisory firm that works with individuals, corporations, and foundations through its offices in Aspen and Denver. Coming up live from the Aspen Institute's Ideas Festival at 10:20, Crime and Punishment, Rebuilding Trust Between Police and Communities of Color. Now, performance today. Good morning.
Donald Trump, meanwhile, may be taking a page out of Sanders' book. Trump is seeking